Well, thank you all for coming. I feel greatly honored to have been asked to give the Norton Lectures this year. So honored that maybe I'll be the first such lecturer to begin with a quotation from that esteemed theologian, Joni Mitchell. In her song, Both Sides Now, she sings of, looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's clouds' illusions, I recall. I really don't know clouds at all. I don't know if other Norton Lecture folks have begun with Joni Mitchell. I suspect that there aren't a whole lot of Norton Lecturers who were at one point members of the Communist Party. I recall the illusions in my own life. I recall God challenging me during the 1970s in many ways, in some unusual ways. He changed me by putting a copy of the New Testament in Russian in my room that I had gotten as a souvenir a couple years earlier and picked up in 1974 just to get some reading practice in Russian, or so I thought. I started studying Russian to be able to speak with my Soviet big brothers. And yet reading the New Testament in Russian changed me. I was teaching as a graduate student at the University of Michigan and was assigned to teach a course in early American literature, which I had never studied, but this is the way it often works in graduate school. You get assigned to things, you have no opportunity to redress grievances. So I started reading early American literature, which to a large extent appeared in sermons. So these dead white males from 300 years ago were preaching to me, and that changed my life. And then God also changed me by, at one point in 1977, after I'd become a Christian, I was giving a talk in Indianapolis. There was a pastor named Ed Steele, a Reformed pastor, who took me aside and said I had a few things to learn theologically. I had a lot to learn. And he introduced me to John Calvin. And that had certainly an influence in my thinking, in part because what Calvin taught about God calling us rather than we searching for God conformed so clearly to my own experience. I was not searching for God. God in his providence and his kindness, his grace, put these things in front of me that led me to him. So if the most important trait we can bring to the study of God's word and God's world is humility, I have lots and lots of reasons for humility. I have nothing at all to boast about in my coming to Christ, nor really in my studying. I am an amateur theologian at best. I'm an elder in the Presbyterian Church of America and was a very active elder for 10 years in Austin. Somewhat dormant now that my wife and I have moved to New York City. But, you know, once an elder, always an elder, so I may have certain pretensions to know some things, but I'm very much an amateur theologian, and speaking before y'all who are studying, and many of you will become pastors, I am a fallen and sinful and deeply limited amateur theologian. So I'm grateful to God for changing my life, yet not changing it so much that I was driven to study Greek and go to seminary. So I am very impressed with all of you, and please do not hesitate to challenge my observations and correct me when, I'll say when, not if, when I go astray. So with that as prologue, I'll plunge in with this observation. It's very misleading to call one of the most famous New Testament stories the parable of the prodigal son. It should be the parable of the two sons, or the two brothers, because each in his way is rebelling against God's grace, much as I rebelled against God. Now, I started thinking about the parable of the prodigal son through the sermons of one of America's finest preachers, Tim Keller, who's senior pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in Manhattan. So I started with his observations, but I'm now going to lead into some political and cultural impressions and applications for which he is clearly not responsible. I'll offer these applications in seven areas today, and then I'll lay out a way to help our warring younger and elder brothers move, I hope, towards some understanding of truth and some peace in these areas. But let me start briefly by reviewing the parable. I won't go into this very much because I suspect you're all familiar with it. You know the story from chapter 15 of Luke. The younger brother is the obvious problem. He takes his share of family wealth, one-third according to Middle Eastern convention, and as you know, he wastes it all in libertine living until perilous poverty forces him to change. He heads home prepared to grovel in front of his dad. Tradition demands the entire village would chastise him. He's gone and done this terrible thing. He's wasted all this money. He places his hope in an artfully prepared speech. But his father runs out to greet him. No groveling is needed. His father gives him the family's finest robe and orders up a feast. Now, there are some nuances to the story that I've garnered from Tim Keller. And Tim preached about this parable last year. He discussed it in a book of his that came out called The Prodigal God. And so let me just mention a few of these nuances and then go to these political and cultural applications. Some nuances. In ancient times, as at present, in the Middle East, sons typically received their inheritance when their fathers died. So the younger son's request to take his share immediately was akin to wishing his father dead. The conventional Middle Eastern patriarch would slap his son, but the father in the parable gives the son what he wants. And the people listening to Jesus 2,000 years ago would have been absolutely shocked by the father's reaction. This is just so weird. Now, when the prodigal returns, the father runs out to meet him. And that, again, that's uncouth behavior in the Middle East then and now. Patriarchs do not pick up their robes and run to a child. A lot of Muslims and Jews, and I come from a Jewish background originally, a lot of Muslims and Jews do not like the idea of a compassionate God who runs to embrace sinners. What kind of God is that? But the father in the parable shows his extraordinary compassion. What we often understate, and this is something that I should have observed myself, but didn't really until educated by Tim Keller in this, what we often understate is the problem of the elder son. When the father puts on a feast to welcome back the son, the younger son, the elder son, is resentful. He complains to the father, "These many years I have served you." And notice what he says. It's not "these many years I have developed my talents," or "these many years I've exercised my creativity." It's "these many years I've served you like a drudge." And since that was the attitude of the elder brother, it's not surprising that the younger brother did not want any part of what looked like slavery. So the elder brother, it appears, has done everything right, but joylessly, reliable, but self-righteous. He did not go out searching for his younger brother, which would be an act of love as well as an act of obligation in Middle Eastern circles. He refuses to celebrate his brother's return or even acknowledge their relationship. He complains to the father about "your son, not my brother." His lack of love leaves him ready to shame his father by boycotting the party. The eldest sons at banquets had the duty but also the honor of checking to make sure that all the guests were adequately fed and watered. He doesn't do that. He's outside. Strikingly, the father shows his compassion once again by leaving the banquet he's hosting. This is a highly unusual event in Middle Eastern custom, especially when guests are eating the fatted calf. Father leaves the banquet to go plead with his elder son. And the parable leaves us in suspense as to what the elder son will do. Because by tradition, the elder son has a very strong case. Should not the just father punish the prodigal instead of giving him what looks like a reward? The father forgives. The elder brother does not. The father does not forget, but he purposely puts aside the younger brother's conduct. The elder brother remembers it. The father is willing to accept the younger brother in a way that will change future family dynamics, but the elder brother, much as he dislikes what he sees as his current slavery, does not want change. So the heart of the problem is really not past or present, but wistfulness. The elder brother wants revenge because he thinks the younger brother had fun, and he wants that fun too. The elder brother works hard, but he desires a prodigal lifestyle. The difference between the elder and the younger in some ways is that the younger was obnoxious enough to act out his desires, while the elder brother repressed his. So if we are jealous of those who live out the Playboy philosophy, we are no better than they. The difference, in fact, is that we are cowards. Now, Jesus was speaking to Pharisees who lived by the elder brother's rule book, upholding Israel's traditions but redlining grace. Today, we still have younger brothers who live just to fulfill their own desires, and many Christians fight against a libertine culture. And there's no question that younger brothers need to change. But what about the people, it may be many of us, who are orderly, responsible decision makers? As Keller puts it, the parable teaches, quote, that a man who has violated virtually nothing on the list of moral misbehaviors can be every bit as spiritually lost as the most profligate, immoral person. Elder brothers believe that if they live a good life, they should get a good life, that God owes them a smooth road if they try very hard to live up to standards, end quote. So, again, here's the time to ask ourselves some questions. Do we have tendencies to be elder brothers? And we can be elder brothers if we moralistically lecture others without truly loving them. I am an elder brother if I point my finger at behavior I don't like and I overlook, as the saying goes, when you point your finger, four fingers point back at you. So I may have elder brother tendencies. We all may. And this is something we have to think about and look at ourselves. Now, I think as a culture in America, we have problems of both elder brothers and younger brothers, and I want to look at some specific areas of our culture where our understanding can be improved when we see that elder brothers as well as younger brothers have problems. And those of you, if there are any of you foolish enough to take notes, you may actually want to take notes perhaps in two columns, because first I'm going to speak about, you know, here are the problems. Here we see elder and younger brother problems. And then I'm going to go back and speak in these seven areas about where there may be different understandings if we approach this biblically and we think through biblically and we become, in essence, a third brother. Or perhaps, in a way, somewhat Christ-like. Hard and difficult, though, that is for all of us as fallen sinners. But first, let me start with education, then. Problems of younger and elder brothers in education. In K through 12 schools, or especially elementary schools, there's often a tendency, I've seen this as I was mentioning to some folks at lunch, my wife and I were involved in starting a Christian school in Austin, Texas 8 years ago, and involved in thinking through teachers and a little bit of hiring and so forth. The tendency often in elementary school is for beleaguered teachers to praise compliant kids and to be annoyed by rambunctious ones. Elder brothers and sisters, people with those tendencies, have the tendency to do well in school. And teachers sometimes have a hard time determining. As to use one Texas saying, the hard thing sometimes is to determine what is sin and what is boy. I was a compliant student through the eighth grade. I was better in school than I was on the athletic fields. And I got compliments that way. There are other kids who were more rambunctious. I saw both sides. So I may have had elder brother tendencies right then. In higher education, certainly we have lots and lots of younger brother colleges, party schools that proffer sex and stimulants. And then some Christian colleges try to avoid that by imposing very tight rules in elder brother fashion. And again, I am certainly not in favor of the younger brother schools, but rules at elder brother schools may lead to external conformity and may lead to self-righteous attitudes rather than deep belief. So it's important to grasp that both younger brother and elder brother colleges divert students from learning more about God and thus create perhaps some big problems. We move to a second American pastime, politics. Democrats in the past have often been younger brother candidates, emphasizing spending our inheritances and embracing alternative lifestyles. You know, in the South, sometimes there aren't as many distinctions between Democrats and Republicans culturally as there are in the North and the West, but they're still there to some extent. Republicans have often been elder brothers, sometimes not having much fun but talking about morality. And races, political races between younger and elder brothers are often toss-ups. Most voters don't favor libertines, but they also don't like those at least portrayed as prigs. This is going back a way for some of you, but those of you who remember back in 1998, 1999, Bill Clinton was the younger brother. Special Prosecutor Ken Starr was the older brother. And Clinton won the battle for public opinion. In 2008, actually, Barack Obama came off as the more mature person when the stock market tanked a year ago, 13 months ago at this point almost, and John McCain raced here and there. Obama's family values helped him to overcome the suspicion that he, like some other Democratic candidates, was a younger brother. And that really won the election. He came across as not neither a younger brother nor an elder brother. McCain came across in some ways as both. Younger brothers have tremendously enjoyed the recent scandals that we reported on in World involving a Christian ministry's house on C Street in Washington, where there have been at least three notable politicians who were involved with that and were also involved in adultery. Because some pundits wrongly identify Christianity with an obvious morality, they think that the Christian conservative ideal is to be an elder brother. So it's a terrific break for the younger brothers when those who have spoken as elder brothers, for example, South Carolina's Governor Mark Sanford, or John Ensign, the senator from Nebraska, or Chip Pickering, the congressman from Mississippi, when they act like younger brothers, this is a tremendous gift to the younger brothers. They can say, you elder brothers, you lecture us all the time, but you're just like us, except you're hypocrites, you're even worse. A third younger versus elder brother combat zone concerns clearly homosexuality. A couple years ago, I covered Manhattan's humongous gay pride parade, and the marching gays refrained from lip locks, except when they passed by a dozen souls from a church at the corner of about 48th Street and 5th Avenue. These folks waved big Bibles at them and yelled at them, "You're going to hell, sodomite," or "You're an abomination in the sight of God." Now, I interviewed the protesters, those people from a church in New Jersey, and one of them told me, "Well, someone's going to stand for the truth," which is true. But elder brothers have the tendency to forget that truth without love is like sodium without chloride. It's poison. Whereas sodium and chloride together, of course, NaCl, salt. The presence of the self-righteous elder brothers allowed the prancing younger brothers actually to feel self-righteous. And it was interesting. Ironically, the ranting reminders about sin provided the opportunity to forget about sin, because they could then point their finger at the elder brothers and say, "We're better than that." Turning to a fourth area, work. I tend to cheer for elder brothers against younger ones. You know, elder brothers, younger ones put play before work, and then they often put off work altogether. But elder brothers, even when laboring very vigorously and conscientiously, also have problems. Dorothy Sayers has a wonderful book. She's a mystery writer who also was very interested in theological things. A few decades ago. She has a classic book called Creator Chaos. And she describes in that book those folks who work to make money and they view the actual result of their work as a byproduct. Quote, "Doctors practice medicine not primarily to relieve suffering, but to make a living. The cure of the patient is something that happens on the way. Lawyers accept briefs not because they have a passion for justice, but to obtain money." End quote. And the plight of certain jobs and industries in America shows what happens when work becomes mere money making, without creativity. Look at the auto companies, for example. There were precise work rules negotiated between union and management that often gave employees one specific assignment on the assembly line. So here was the deal that went on for a number of decades. Become a robot at work, have lots of cash for evenings and weekends, where real living occurs. Happy hours begin. Weekends are made for Michelob, and so forth. Some younger brothers want to know part of that. Others compromised by smashing out parts during their 7 or 8 hours of work and then getting smashed every evening. Elder brothers accepted this. They worked joylessly, efficiently, and now their jobs have disappeared. When we treat work in elder brother fashion as merely an ATM, the immediate result might be more money, but the long-term prospect is disastrous. Doesn't lead to creativity, doesn't really help us honor God in the way we we use the minds and talents God has given us. Journalism is a fifth area in which younger and elder brothers compete. Younger brother magazines, let's say along the lines of most obviously, notoriously Playboy or Rolling Stone or even People, sell the libertine life. People magazine a few years ago had its list of the 100 greatest romances, and most of them were adulterous. Supermarket tabloids, lots of cable shows make money off of lascivious sensationalism without explicitly approving it, but it gets good ratings. On the other hand, there are also elder brother journalists who are self-righteous fault finders, and it's always someone else's fault. The tendency of elder brothers is not to understand, to use one term that was used very much at John Piper's conference in Minneapolis this weekend, where I had the privilege to speak and listen to others speaking. People said that we are broken actors on a broken stage. That's who we are post-fall. Elder brother journalists tend to be fault finders without understanding that elder brothers also are broken actors on a broken stage. Elder brother journalism lacks love, charity, compassion, any sense that all of us, because of the human condition, are in this mess together, broken actors on a broken stage. And Christian publications that look only at sin among secularists and praise churches as if they were eminently and obviously centers of virtue, they can also be elder brothers. Six, media, and particularly American films. I have a friend in New York, a screenwriter who is a Christian, a fellow named Kenan Minkoff. And as we were talking about this, his brain started working, and he wrote recently an interesting paper, a thorough analysis of some hit films created by staunchly younger brother minds. And so you go back even from the late 60s to the present. Even the good characters, especially the good characters, in films like, I don't know if some of you have seen them, Easy Rider from the late 60s, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest from the 70s, American Beauty from the 90s, and I could point to lots of recent ones. The heroes typically are younger brothers. The elder brothers are portrayed as evil. What's ingenious about the films is this: audiences can vicariously enjoy the younger brother's sensual pleasures and at the same time can enjoy the elder brother's thrill of self-righteous, moralistic outrage. And the moralistic outrage is directed, ironically, at the film's nefarious elder brother. Give you some examples. 1975, younger brother sexuality not only feels good, but it's so transcendent that it literally, in a movie, heals the sick. If any of you have seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, or the book in which it's based by Ken Kesey. Sex cures the timid, stuttering Billy Bibbit. Elder brother sexual repression is so destructive that it literally kills the healed. Billy Bibbit is so fearful of parental reproof that he commits suicide. So Hollywood reflects America in a love affair with younger brothers in love, but it also reflects America in its love affair with false third brother perspectives within films. Because Minkoff knows that there are last-minute false apologies sometimes for the real values that are communicated by the experience of the film. It's like a character is gleefully engaged in 99 minutes of voluptuous adultery, and the last minute, the character stops and says, "Oh, now I realize how much I love my wife." So you get it both ways. And American Beauty, I won't go into the details here, is a film like that, that of course won Academy Awards. The hero in that spends 99 minutes actively pursuing pedophilic adultery. And then just as he has undressed an acquiescent 15-year-old, he stops and realizes, "Oh, I love my wife and my own 15-year-old daughter." And then, of course, before he has a chance to show in any way that he's changed, the elder brother next door, of course, a repressed homosexual, murders him. So this is the typical film language. The younger brother is hero. Discussing the hypocrisy of elder brothers. Seventh and last here, the long-running welfare debate also pits younger against elder brothers. Many people equate social justice with governmental redistribution, and I'll talk more about this later on today. And it's certainly true that God wants widows and orphans to receive help, although not probably from Washington. But many recipients are younger brothers or sisters. Many recipients of welfare payments over the past four decades are younger brothers or sisters who should go home. They're prodigals who have left home. They should go home, but they don't because government checks have allowed them to keep destroying themselves. Elder brothers tend to focus on wastrels, people wasting this money, and they overlook the real needs that sometimes exist. That's because since the beginning of the 20th century, we've tended to have had a social universalism that emphasizes distribution to all without consideration of character. And then a lot of elder brothers become social Darwinists who reach for their revolvers when they hear the word compassion. I wrote a book back in the early 90s called The Tragedy of American Compassion, and it's been re-released recently, in which talk about three types of poverty fighting. There's social Darwinism, which basically says abandon the poor, the social universalism, which says pass out money to everyone, and what worked in American history during the 18th and 19th century, and the book lays this out, is social Calvinism, which looked at both our spiritual and our material responsibilities. But that's all gone by the by for the most part. Our prodigious government tends to subsidize prodigal sons today and prodigal daughters. So I took a crack at writing a parable of the prodigal son for today. And the first half of it goes the same way. You're familiar with the prodigal son leaving home, going off to a far country, wasting his money. But at the point where the starving prodigal son is ready to go home, here's the alternative way in which it would be written these days. The younger son got up to go to his father, but an official approached him and said, "Did you hear of our Senate decree that no one will go hungry? Here's your ration. Everyone in need gets the same amount." Now, the younger son started to object. He started to say, "Well, I've realized that I messed up. I'm ready to go home." But then he thinks, "Well, I have dinner here. I might as well enjoy a final fling tonight. Tomorrow, I'll head home." Tomorrow and more tomorrows came and went. The younger son stayed on. The father sat on his porch, gazing sadly at the highway. After a long time, he said to the elder son, "Could you do an internet search for your brother?" The elder brother sneered, "Why should I look for this son of yours who has devoured your assets with prostitutes?" Later, though, the elder brother found his brother's address. Again, this is our modern parable. He emailed him, "Look, you sinner, haven't you caused enough problems? I slave away all day, but you're a blot in our family's honor." The younger brother replied, "You're always bossing me around. Why should I join you in slaving away?" The younger brother sent copies of his email to friends and associates in the far country. The elder brother did the same to his contacts. Readers of those emails egged on the brothers. The elder brother set up the Moral Brother Foundation. The younger set up the Younger Brother's Rights Campaign. Money poured in. Each brother hired ghostwriters to craft more letters with underlining, italics, and exclamation points. More money rolled in, end quote. Well, enough of that. That's the prodigal son parable in our modern day. But let's move on to what to do. I've given these seven areas where there are problems, as we have younger brothers and elder brothers. But when we try to look from both sides, and we try to give it kind of a biblical 360, we can see that neither life as a prodigal nor life as a tut-tutting elder brother is biblical. And again, our tendency sometimes in the church is to fall into elder brother patterns of seeing the younger brothers as sinners, but so are we. Younger brothers yearn for love, and so do we in the churches. And when they look for love in all the wrong places, we should not tell them to stop looking for love, but to look in the right place. When an alcoholic tells us he's thirsty, we should show him the way to living water. So, in my tongue-in-cheek modernization of the parable, I can introduce now one more character of the modern parable of the prodigal son. And there was a third brother who was intent on doing the will of the father, and he understood the father loved him. Because he had experienced that love, he had love for others and patience with them. First, he journeyed to the far country, and because he knew both love and truth, he could ask the younger brother questions that helped him to recognize the new slavery into which he'd entered. And the third brother, with love and patience, also spoke with the elder brother, asking him questions to help him understand the father's wisdom. He helped the elder brother to see that both younger and elder were worshiping idols. Instant pleasure in one case, joyless duty in the other, end quote. And then it went on from there, I hope, with reconciliation and a banquet in which both the younger and the elder brother would enjoy with all the neighbors and the father, the fatted calf. And maybe a third brother paradigm can help us to some fresh thinking on alternatives in many areas to this younger brother, elder brother clash. Let me go quickly then through these seven areas that I spoke of earlier. In education, a third brother evangelical college, or a third brother Christian school in the K-12 area. A third brother evangelical college, let's say, will emphasize intellectual and spiritual challenge and change rather than external conformity. It'll stress in classes that all people are made in God's image and that all people sin. Instead of dividing the world into good guys and bad guys, professors at a third brother college will recognize that Christians will often disappoint us because of the omnipresence of sin. And non-Christians may often surprise us favorably because of the omnipresence of God's image, even if marred. Again, we are ruined actors on a ruined stage, but we still bear God's image. And that way we can sometimes be favorably surprised by non-Christians learning some things that they actually, through common grace, have understood. And we also won't fall into the pattern of just being cheerleaders for elder brothers. Second, third brother politics. Younger brothers forget that Americans in the 18th century fought for both liberty and virtue. They tend to ignore the virtue part. Elder brothers who are Christian conservatives often think that the right laws will help America to become the new Israel. Elder brothers who are secular liberals tend to think that the right laws will help America to become the new Europe. Both sets of elder brothers emphasize preaching at people. But third brothers know that we can never have enough laws to banish sin. Laws fail. Christ changes lives. And that's so important in a whole lot of areas. Not to fixate on laws, but to emphasize changing culture, changing minds, changing heart, from which laws do follow. But laws are a trailing indicator. Changed hearts are the leading indicator of all kinds of cultural and political and social and economic change. And often in Christian circles, we've tended to mistake that. We've tended to, in an elder brother way, think that if only there's a law, if only the Supreme Court would change in certain ways, then everything would be better. But again, it's not the nine justices or five justices, perhaps, who are bad guys. We are all ruined actors on a ruined stage. Third, the debate about same-sex marriage. You know, we evangelicals, we come across as elder brothers when we scream at gay rights activists without acknowledging that there's plenty of sin to go around. Homosexuals question, with some reasonability, Christian commitment when the divorce rate of those within churches remains high. Again, in most of our churches, I mean, it's clear what the Bible has to say about homosexuality. It's wrong. In most of our churches, heterosexual adultery is a much bigger problem than homosexuality. And without lessening the biblical teaching about homosexuality, there's a lot more we have to do in our churches to strengthen marriage. And if we don't do that, we come across as elder brothers pointing fingers. And again, there have been some very prominent family values leaders who become known as adulterers. It's hard to be to be effective unless we acknowledge the problem and work at least as hard at repairing our own houses as complaining about the houses of others. And some of the defenses of marriage, let me say, are also uninspiring. I mean, I've heard lots of sermons and lectures about faithfulness in marriage. This is a duty. Or is a standard to uphold? Well, yes, it is a standard worth upholding, and vows become duties. But if that's all that it is, we are left with an elder brother marriage that won't impress anyone. Our defense should be not just that traditional marriage fosters superior health and longevity and economic benefit and security and healthier and better adjusted children and so forth. I mean, that's all true. But we should also be able to explain to people and show in our own marriages that marriage is a lot of fun. And God created fun. If our marriages are not filled with love, they are only resounding gongs or clanging cymbals. You know, the idea of falling in love is sometimes a conduit toward younger brother irresponsibility. That I've noticed some Christians poo-pooing the notion of love, and even suggesting that arranged marriages are better. That won't work. And of course, instead of screaming at gay rights activists, we should control our tongues and lungs because our goal is to change hearts. And for that reason, we should say and show that marriage is more than a contract, because our goal is to inspire hearts. Fourth, third brothers have a different view of the nature of work. I mentioned about the difficulty of elder and younger brothers there. But as Tim Keller and other people have pointed out, chapter 2 of Genesis, God brings order out of chaos and then says to man, now you create order. I mean, Abraham is a gardener. He's not a park ranger. A gardener rearranges the raw material of nature in a particular domain so that it helps flourishing, helps everyone to flourish. Work, including manual labor, has dignity because God first formed man from the dust of the ground. And so God rejoices in the physical, first shaping it and then in the gospel is becoming part of it. Music, for example, is taking the raw material of sound and arranging it so it brings meaning. Architects take wood or steel or other basic materials and create ordered space. Writers bring order to letters and words and so on. So this is work. It's not drudgery, it's creativity. Because we're made in God's image, work should also be play, a way for us to develop God-given creativity. We need to make money. Adam, amid thorns, needed to wrest his bread from the dust, and so do we. But work is not primarily for making money, and if we teach that, if we teach people to settle for that, we're wrong. Work, to quote Dorothy Sayers, is, quote, the gracious expression of creative energy in the service of others, end quote. And the elder brother in the parable apparently did not rejoice as he worked. And a younger brother who witnesses joylessness is unlikely to value gardening over loitering. Fifth, younger brother journalism, third brother journalism, as compared to younger brother or elder brother journalism. Third brother journalism is based on Stephen's history lecture in chapter 7 of the book of Acts. Stephen, you'll remember, he doesn't have an elder brother's self-righteousness, nor does he have a younger brother's scorn for righteousness. Stephen realistically emphasized the sinfulness of God's people and his people, Israel, and the holiness of God. He understands Christian love. He does not seek life's meaning in the formation of or adherence to a man-made religion that sets up a code of morality. Sixth, film. And I'll be short here because there aren't a whole lot of great examples these days of third brother films. Some of the films made from Jane Austen books show that, because her books were basically about the joy of responsibility and how people actually found love in doing the right thing and declined from just being irresponsible adulterers. Western movies, one of their selling points, along with the vistas and the action, were essentially they tended to often be third brother movies. And I actually have to admit I wrote my dissertation in graduate school on film and politics from the 30s to the 70s. And so I dealt with lots of Westerns at that time. And that's a genre that pretty much disappeared, although it's there in some other ways. And the thinking behind it, the emphasis on responsibility, but responsibility mixed with an enjoyment of that responsibility, not just dour, slavish following of what you had to do. A lot of that's gone from American movies. So, this is a short section because there just isn't much in the way of good examples. And maybe some of you can think of some good examples, and so let me know. Seventh and last, let me mention what's happened in the pro-life movement as an example. This a little bit deviates from my parallelism, but it's an example of the way coming to a third brother position enormously helped a whole cultural movement. 20 years ago, legislative and judicial approaches had pretty much bogged down. But in the pro-life movement at that time, there tended to be an all or nothing perspective. That is, anyone that we had to have a complete ban on abortion, there had to be a constitutional amendment outlawing abortion, and that was all or else nothing. So anyone who, let's say, pushed for restrictions on late-term abortions or partial birth abortion, and if a person pushed for those restrictions but did not demand a complete reversal of Roe v. Wade, then That person sometimes was treated as an accomplice to baby killers. Other people at the time were blocking entrances to abortion businesses as part of Operation Rescue, even though polls showed that Operation Rescue was actually was making Americans more likely to support abortion. And the leaders of some of these movements, the All or Nothing folks and Operation Rescue, the leaders at that time, tended to view pregnant unmarried moms as moral deviants requiring stern lectures. In other words, they had an elder brother attitude towards a younger brother, or in this case, many younger sisters. And as they lectured and hectored, the pro-abortion populace grew. One poll 2 decades ago showed 2.5 times as many Americans classified themselves as pro-choice, to use that language, as pro-life. Over the past 20 years, though, public opinion has shifted. And a majority of Americans now tell pollsters that abortion is morally wrong, and more Americans, a majority of Americans, identify themselves as pro-life and not pro-choice. And during this period, the number of abortions per year has declined from its 1.6 million peak 2 decades ago to 1.2 million or fewer now, which is obviously still a horrendous number, but it's not the butcher's bill of 4 million that people were predicting back when Roe v. Wade legalized abortion nationwide in 1973. And there actually has been this decline. So what happened? I had the privilege over a 5-year period beginning in 1989 to attend and for a time chair quarterly meetings of pro-life leaders. And during that period, there was a crucial transition. A critical mass of the pro-life movement began moving from the all-or-nothing demand to an all-or-something approach that aimed eventually, hopefully, for complete protection of unborn children, but in the short run strove to keep alive as many as possible. And accompanying this was the understanding of what became known and called love them both, troubled mom and at-risk unborn children. Pro-life groups, instead of portraying women as the bad gal murderers here, portrayed them accurately as victims in many situations, usually abandoned by their boyfriends and sometimes husbands when they became pregnant and feeling they had no option. The faces of the movement became compassionate and reasonable pro-life women rather than angry young males, which were much preferred by the television networks. So that took some work. Leaders emphasized the American tradition of expanding the community of care rather than restricting it, and thus were able to start portraying Roe v. Wade not as a progressive decision but a real reactionary one. And critically, the compassionate arm of the pro-life movement expanded. The leading umbrella group for pregnancy counseling centers, CareNet, had fewer than 300 centers 20 years ago and now has 1,000 times more. Excuse me, it now has an additional 1,000. But it's up to about 1,300 now. And even Time magazine reported recently that, quote, the quiet campaign for women's hearts and minds conducted in thousands of crisis pregnancy centers around the country and on phone banks, on billboards, through websites is having an effect. And I won't go through all the details here. You've been patient enough. But this was basically turning from elder brothers haranguing younger brothers into third brothers, realizing, you know, the women in the situation are victims in many ways. We need to come alongside them. We need to help them. The change did not come easily. There were some rancorous sessions in the early 90s. But the movement was from elder brother finger wagging to a patient third brother position. And let me just give you, to close here, one example of how this worked out in practice. What is actually being a third brother like? Juan DeCone is director of the Pregnancy Care Center in Leesburg, Florida. And every year in World in December, we have our Daniel of the Year, someone who has stood up against largely the secular liberal culture and taken some heat for it, but tried to honor Christ in everything he or she did. And Wanda herself had an abortion in 1977 when she was 17 years old, and then she became a Christian during the 1980s and has worked with incredible love and care and precision, directing this crisis pregnancy center in Leesburg, which is about an hour's drive northwest of Orlando. And over a couple of years, and still today, Wanda copies me in on some of the emails she sends because I wanted to write about a pro-life counselor and then much to her surprise and shock, I mean, she became our Daniel of the Year. I'll give you just two excerpts from Wanda's emails, and then one from an email sent to her. So here's one of her emails. Quote, she's sweet but scared, and she's carried a huge burden for months as she has hid her pregnancy. I asked her, do you believe in God? Yes, she said. I proceeded to tell her how God calls us to protect the innocent, her baby, how he created the womb as a place for safety, not danger, and how I myself went through this. And now she's not going to have an abortion. Thank you, Jesus. Or another email. I never even got a chance to sit at my desk this morning from a very early morning call. I'm not doing well. I need you to come to my house to see me now. To a late evening call from a mom whose 15-year-old daughter had told her after talking to me on the phone that she was not getting the abortion her mom had scheduled the next morning. I consider that baby's survival to be a miracle from God, end quote. And then here's part of a note sent to Wanda by a man who several years before had fathered an unborn child. The child was about to die until Wanda Cohn helped the mom see an alternative. Quote, the baby was born in October. Today he is a 3-year-old bringing joy and happiness in our lives every moment. I have no words to thank you for what you have done for me, my wife, and the baby, end quote. So Wanda Cohn, a third brother, understands that her work is to use that that very nice expression from Dorothy Sayers, her work is, quote, the gracious expression of creative energy in the service of others, end quote. That is joyful labor. That's what we should be partaking of, both for our sake and for the sake of the younger and elder brothers who are watching. As the Apostle Paul wrote, love is patient, love is kind, so is a third brother. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices in the truth. So does a third brother rejoice, and so should we. Thank you very much.